Chapter 6 Utopia. Children of a future age, reading this indignant page, know that in a former time, love, sweet love, was thought a crime. William Blake. That useless dreamer be forever cursed, who, while obsessed in his stupidity with insoluble puzzles, was the first to try and mix love and morality. Charles Baudelaire. Better loving through chemistry. Among the anxieties aroused by the science of love, the fear that love might lose its value just because we can explain it is not worth taking seriously. The more sinister prospect unveiled by the neuroscience of love is that of chemical control. In a striking short story first published in The New Yorker, George Saunders imagines experiments in which drugs, administered remotely, control both the onset and the obliteration of limerence. Intense feelings of love and desire for targets whose individual qualities are irrelevant are triggered with the suddenness of Oberon's love potion in the ear of Titania. An hour later, an antidote erases them completely. The brevity of the episode would not be surprising in sheer lust, but Saunders' characters are experiencing full-blown limerence or romantic love. To block the thought that his characters are briefly sensitized to one another's lovable core self, Saunders specifies that all are convicted murderers, physically unattractive and morally repellent. Comparable love drugs may well soon actually become available. Ethical review boards need to be prepared for the moment when marriage counselors will have to decide whether to recommend them. Will it be ethical to prescribe pills in the service of monogamy? Assuming, just for the sake of argument, that monogamy is an unequivocally good thing, Oxford philosopher Brian Earp has suggested that couples should be free to strengthen their bond with love-enhancing drugs. Perhaps, under certain conditions, it might even be their duty to do so. A child's present and future happiness, for example, might depend on the endurance of their parents' union. Promises made in the marriage ceremony not only bear on what you can do for one another, they also commit you to love one another till death do you part. However rash that promise may now seem, only the impossibility of keeping it could relieve you of the obligation it created. The availability of a chemical that will enable you to feel loving at will, as well as motivating you to behave in loving ways, could bring about what formerly seemed impossible. Given your promise, the existence of the drug would put you under a moral obligation to use it. Anti-love drugs, like those that terminate the one-hour episode in Saunders' story, might soon be available as well. They, too, would provide a tool for the protection of monogamy, or, for that matter, to ease the heartache of monogamy's failures. The moment you feel yourself drawn to someone other than your partner, just pop an anti-love pill. Of course, one would need to develop techniques to avoid the sorts of accidents of proximity that prove so confusing for the hapless lovers of A Midsummer Night's Dream, who keep getting drugged into loving the wrong partner. Once such bugs are taken care of, however, love and anti-love drugs would essentially close the gap between limerence and attachment. A dose of enhancement here, a dose of suppression there, and everyone could effectively be kept on the straight and narrow path of monogamy. This happy conclusion may be grounded in a false dilemma. There are thriving couples who practice swinging. Their goal is not to undermine monogamy, but to enhance and preserve it. This suggests that the superior happiness of monogamous couples is not based on their sexual exclusiveness, but on the harmony between their ideology, their practice, and their inclinations. Swingers recognize the separability of love's different syndromes and accept that long-term conjugal attachment need not be threatened by the enjoyment of lust with other partners. But their happy endorsement of external lust does not extend to any emotional affinity. To ward off the danger of emotional ties, swingers erect a complex web of rules and conventions. Etiquette requires that incipient limerence be nipped in the bud wherever possible. The difference in the swinger lifestyle lies in the attempt to welcome rather than repress the vagaries of lust and desire. Love's ideologists and rebels. The stringent rules of love have always had both enforcers and rebels. In modern Western societies, the rules are defined by monogamism, an ideology distinct from the practice of monogamy. Monogamy may reflect individual choices, which are inevitably influenced but not inflexibly determined by the dominant ideology. Monogamism is neither a choice nor a practice. It is a normative system, as firmly enforced by regular adulterers as the war on drugs is sustained by drug lords. Their arguments in favor of it are barely less questionable than those once made in support of racial segregation, or those still heard against same-sex marriage. But they are widely taken for granted, and they are very costly to oppose. In some ways, every limerent lover is a rebel against the social order. The literatures of ancient China, India, and Greece all contain legends of forbidden loves, usually but not invariably between a man and a woman. Most of them end in death. Their death is sometimes followed by an afterlife as a flower, as in the story of Hyacinth and Apollo, or as a pair of butterflies, as in the legend of Ying Taizhu and Shan Boliang. Although it was once fashionable to proclaim that romantic love was a European invention of the age of troubadours, ethnographers have found stories of limerence in nearly 90% of cultures surveyed. Among the rebels, there are moralists and immoralists. Libertines of the 17th and 18th centuries, such as the Marquis de Sade or the Earl of Rochester, professed scorn for any type of morality. By any standards, they behaved badly. That was part of the fun. Apart from the inherent excitement of rebellion, one might speculate that the repression of love and sex encourages an implicit syllogism which can look tempting, though it is obviously fallacious. Love and sex provide intense pleasure. The repression of love and sex makes them criminal. Therefore, all crime can be expected to provide pleasure. Not all the rebels of sex and love are immoralists. On the contrary, modern champions of free love, same-sex marriage, open relationships, or polyamory can moralize as tediously as popes. Their charge sheet against monogamist ideology comprises sexism, denial of reality, and hypocrisy. Their main demand is for consistent observance of some of the traditional truisms about love, stripped of the small print that commonly undermines the spirit of their ideals. Foremost among those truisms is the belief that love is concerned for the beloved's welfare and happiness. In the ideology of monogamism, however, this is qualified by conditions constraining how the beloved's happiness arises and who may contribute to it. The tacit small print in the contract of monogamist emotional and sexual love specifies, "I want your happiness, but only if I cause it." Similarly, if love is the joy of contemplating the beloved's autonomy, it should not be conditional on the beloved's making acceptable use of that autonomy. Recall the theological parallel: free will is God's great gift, but eternal damnation is your lot if you misuse it. Again, if love is an imaginative effort to empathize with your beloved and to see her clearly, there should be no list of unacceptable states of mind. Here, the small print reads, "I love you as you are and for yourself, but I'll be watching you for signs of thought crimes." A thought crime is any thought or impulse that doesn't fit the idea the lover has formed of the beloved's virtues. If love is accepting the beloved's feelings, I must accept your feelings for another. But that one works both ways. You have to accept my jealousy. Yes, but accepting that jealousy occurs doesn't mean instituting a right to express it in acts of rage and revenge. We can accept a father's distress when his daughter's love affair incurs social disapproval in traditional subcultures, but we don't accept honor as a legitimate motive for killing girls. Similarly, the radical moralist who rejects monogamism insists, someone's longing for possessive control of his beloved is an understandable human weakness, but it entails no ownership rights that society should enforce. Finally, if love targets the beloved's authentic individuality, for better, for worse, the lover cannot take it for granted that the beloved will forever remain impossibly single-minded. When I agreed to for better, for worse, I never imagined that you might also love another. Polyamorists distinguish themselves sharply from advocates of polygamy. The latter usually refers to polygyny as practiced by oppressively patriarchal societies. Furthermore, in contrast to swingers, polyamorists typically accept the possibility that a partnership might be extended to include others. They are prepared to face the phenomenon known as NRE, or New Relationship Energy. NRE arises from limerence for a new partner. If John, who loves Jane, falls into limerence with Jack or Mary, his preferences and habits are liable to change for a while. Those changes may well prove uncomfortable for Jane and arouse her jealousy. Unlike most monogamous couples, however, both John and Jane are aware of the inherently short-lived character of limerence. They strive not to succumb to its disruptive power. They also acknowledge that it might lead to an enlargement of their unit, as well as risk its dissolution. History provides a few famous examples of happy enlargements, such as that of Sir William and Lady Hamilton, whose loving partnership was enhanced by the addition of Lord Nelson. G.B. Shaw noted that the secret of this household of three was not only that both the husband and Nelson were devoted to Lady Hamilton, but that they were also apparently devoted to one another. When Hamilton died, both Nelson and Emma seemed to have been equally heartbroken. Ideally, a committed polyamorist should respond with joy to his partner's new love. They even have a name for that emotion, calling it compersion, the opposite of jealousy. Is it not part of the very definition of love that it finds happiness in the beloved's happiness? As conceded by sensible self-help books for polyamorists, however, that ideal response is not always easy to achieve. Defenders of traditional monogamy will be keen to interpret this as evidence that jealousy is natural and inevitable. But that could hardly be a compelling objection to the ideal of polyamory, for jealousy does not spare monogamous couples. Indeed, it affects the latter far more destructively, since monogamists take it to be a legitimate response to what they define as betrayal. To the polyamorist, on the contrary, the attraction that the beloved can feel for another can be positively reassuring, for it is a reminder of the fact, undeniable, although commonly denied, that John can love Mary without ceasing to love Jane. John and Jane also recognize the essentially ephemeral character of NRE, and they know that limerence is not identical with forms of attachment and affection that are not similarly time-stamped. Jealousy is unpleasant both for those who feel it and for those at whom it is directed. But it has its defenders as a reliable mark of love, not only among Scottish female prisoners, but also among poets, such as the rakish Earl of Rochester, who put it unequivocally, "Alas, 'tis sacred jealousy, love raised to an extreme, the only proof 'twixt her and me, we love and do not dream." Still, there would seem to be better ways of proving love. even if the early appearance of jealousy in infancy is taken to show it must be, from the point of view of evolutionary psychology, an adaptation that serves some people. Jealousy can be counterproductive. Like other forms of pain, jealous feelings linked to a potential loss of love may be useful as an alarm signal, but jealous rage and aggressive surveillance, like other responses first manifested in infancy, become acceptable in adults only if the ambient social norms reinforce them. In some societies, such as Mediterranean ones, intense jealousy is encouraged as normal and legitimate, to the point of excusing as a crime of passion the murder of a partner caught in flagrante delicto, in the picturesque legal Latin that literally means while the misdeed is blazing. In other societies, such as the Polynesian societies described by Margaret Mead, it can be successfully discouraged, at least to the point of seeming eccentric and ill-mannered, something more like a childish tantrum than a mature emotional response. Nature as ideology. Since modern rebels of love are moralists, they want reform. If there is to be reform, it must be grounded in relevant facts about human nature. But what are those facts? An influential system of morality, stemming from Aristotle and imported by St. Thomas Aquinas into Roman Catholic theology, endows nature with God's benevolent purposes. It presupposes that we can have a sufficient grasp of nature's purposes to identify what expresses our true nature and distinguish it from perversions. Exponents of natural law theory are ready to decree that erotic love and sex are natural in the right way only when they serve reproduction, that only monogamous marriage is compatible with nature's intent, and that other forms of love and sex, including same-sex love, pervert our true nature. Appeals to nature as a guide to true love are often found to be persuasive because most people tend to think of love as the precious gift of a benign nature. But faith in the benevolence of nature ignores the evidence that nature is, at best, indifferent and often behaves as if it were actively malevolent. In fact, human institutions have always attempted to curb or regulate human passions, but conventions and prohibitions aimed at fencing love in have been highly variable. Love is governed by ideology as much as by chemistry. The incoherent prejudices to which love is subject have become less restrictive since the so-called sexual revolution, but they have not changed as much as might have been hoped. This is illustrated not by the representation of homosexual relationships in recent popular culture. Most of those representations cleanse homosexuality of the transgressive character that once provided gay lifestyles with moral seriousness, not to say a touch of glamour. In those privileged places where homosexuals have the right to marry, many profess a new regard for monogamy. Where homosexuality is normal, it no longer carries the torch of erotic radicalism. That's left to the still marginalized advocates of transsexuality, bisexuality, and polyamory. Enforcers and rebels alike agree that love plays a central role in human life, both for happiness and for misery. For that reason, we will never be able to view facts about it dispassionately. Nor is it likely that we could discover the right normative beliefs, for some of the emotional dispositions bequeathed us by natural selection conflict with one another. Limerence is intense, brief, and inherently deceptive. Its very content in our consciousness tricks us into thinking that it will never change. Bonds of affection and affiliation may be less intense, but they are indispensable to social life. And limerence, although we can think of it as setting the stage for affection and attachment, frequently destroys what it first helped to construct. That is why love has so often seemed tragic. Equipped with a little bit of that objectifying attitude that is peculiar to science, you might be able to stand back and see through the illusion. Once you do, there is no reason not to grant that alongside happy monogamous marriages, countless different arrangements are compatible with the diversity of human tastes and temperaments. We should then accept that, for some people, the love of one or more life partners can be enriched rather than doomed by their openness to unconventional experience. In traditional views of human nature, myths and assumptions about right and wrong contaminate beliefs about what is actually true. When a myth bumps up against the reality, ideology persuades us that we are confronting something that nature did not intend. Thus, for example, the self-appointed luminaries of the love coaching industry take for granted the putative fact that Homo sapiens is an essentially monogamous or mildly polygynous species. Even as I write, my local newspaper praises a new book that presents new scientific evidence that tells us that humans are meant to mate for life. But if that were true, would it be so lucrative to keep preaching it? That fits into the standard story told and retold by evolutionary psychologists. But there are increasingly many reasons to doubt its truth. First, the diversity of actual arrangements found in the world reflects the diversity of individual natures at the biological, sociological, and biographical levels. Moralist rebels who advocate alternative conceptions of love can find empirical support from several areas of research. None of these are incontestable. Science differs from myth not in being infallible, but in being aware of its fallibility. Only science, however, can correct both itself and folk wisdom. From primatology, for example, we learn that our most closely related primate cousins are the bonobos, among whom promiscuous sexuality is the foundation of harmonious social life rather than a cause of its disruption. Our female ancestors, far from being coy and choosy in contrast with promiscuous males, seem likely to have behaved more like bonobos than monogamous gibbons. So much is suggested, at least, by an intriguing inference from anatomy. The mushroom shape of the human penis, which is not shared by other species, may be an adaptation that had the function of pumping from a partner's vagina semen recently deposited by other males. Studies of the frequency of extra-pair copulations have indicated that women are more likely to have sexual contact with men who are not their regular partner during the fertile period of their cycle. This suggests that at some unconscious level, females may be inclined to seek out, for their offspring, the genes of men they wouldn't want to be married to. It is perhaps no wonder, then, that while the norm of monogamy shows only a few official cracks in contemporary Western societies, it is everywhere more honored in the breach than the observance. Proofs of possibility. There is also striking anthropological evidence that provides possibility proofs. Examples of arrangements that would be impossible if our conventional expectations of love, male rivalry, and procreation reflected unalterable facts of human nature. One such illustration is provided by the Mosuo, a matrilineal ethnic minority in southwest China where marriage is not practiced. Instead, after the ceremony that marks a girl's passage to womanhood, she gets her own bedroom where men who want to make love to her can knock at her door. She can choose to receive the same or a different lover every night. Her brothers and sisters help to bring up her children. In that way, men propagate their genes through their sisters, not their own paternity, thus evading the biological incentive for violent male rivalry. Another illustration of the possibility of a different configuration is found in certain Amazonian tribes that practice party paternity. In that system, a woman will have many sexual partners, and it is assumed that all her lovers are contributing to the qualities of her offspring. All accept their role as fathers, so the children have several fathers. As they see it, the more fathers contribute their sperm, the greater the inherited virtues and strengths of the offspring. In the context of such arrangements, there is collaboration rather than rivalry, and jealousy is minimized or non-existent. Both these examples are compatible with the premise of the standard evolutionary psychological story that stresses the interests a male should take in the propagation of his genes. At the same time, they show why the conclusions usually drawn, that men should be mildly promiscuous, while women must be jealously protected from other men who might want to protect them, does not follow from that premise. In our own society, it is taken for granted that jealousy is a normal and justified response to fear of loss aroused by the diversion of a partner's attention. Loss of exclusive attention is taken to imply loss of affection. Jealousy can affect beliefs, emotion, and behavior. Hence, common manifestations of jealousy include suspicious thoughts, emotions of sadness or anger, aggressive behavior, or stratagems intended to interrupt communication between the partner and the rival, such as surveillance and persistent questioning. Among those different manifestations of jealousy, only emotional ones, such as sadness, have been found to be positively correlated with love. Emotional manifestations of jealousy are correlated with higher rates of marriage endurance 7 years later. Intrusive surveillance and aggressive behavior, by contrast, are seldom appealing to those at whom they are directed. Unsurprisingly, they erode rather than preserve love. These considerations are hardly likely to be compelling to members of the vast industry devoted to mending broken marriages. Part of the argument for monogamism rests on the claim that exclusivity of sexual and emotional bonding provides security and, hence, lowers the partner's levels of anxiety. But the security is always illusory, in love as in life. And besides, the argument begs the question, for there would be less cause for anxiety if the inception of another loving relationship were not automatically equated with the dissolution of an existing one. Those who acknowledge the possibility of attraction as well as the temporary nature of limerence are less inclined to lie to protect the loved one. Without going as far as Oscar Wilde in insisting that the monogamist conception of fidelity is better regarded as either the lethargy of custom or lack of imagination, one can concede that a notion of fidelity that does not entail forsaking all others is not incoherent. It can be a better protection against betrayal than one which construes fidelity narrowly in terms of exclusive possession. Erotic Utopia. Despite the fact that monogamy is not very widely practiced, we live in a society where monogamism is the dominant ideology. In celebrity culture, for example, hardly anyone conforms to the norm, and yet each infraction is treated as a titillating scandal. Perhaps you, dear listener, have chosen to conform as best you can. You may then want to avail yourself of the possibilities for enhancing your commitment and blunting intrusive temptations afforded by soon-to-be-available drugs. You will then also benefit from the rules and conventions that are implicit in every word and gesture. In that world, everyone understands the intricate rules by which the game of love is played. When words and gestures are codified by long tradition, the scenarios are available off the shelf. Everyone knows what to expect. Alternatively, you may opt to join the growing ranks of those who are more impressed by the diversity of human aspirations than by the attraction of any single form of life. You may then attempt to adjust your relationship to the individual natures, temperaments, and inclinations of the participants. If you make that choice, the familiar rules can no longer be taken for granted. Expectations will have to be nurtured on the basis of mutual insight, supplemented, if need be, by explicit rules worked out between those concerned. You will need to be wary of expectations contaminated by stubborn traces of paradigm scenarios that have not quite been extinguished. Any attempt to make something new makes for an exciting adventure, but is subject to systematic misunderstandings, requiring painful reappraisals. If you make the latter choice, you might think of yourself as helping to usher in a lover's utopia. You are sure to be told that this has been tried and failed before, and is no more likely to work now. But things might be different in an age when brain-altering technology is available from both the chemistry and the computer labs. Traditional wisdom counsels us to change ourselves rather than the world. Until recently, however, we could do little about either. At best, we could steel ourselves to conform to society's norms, or struggle, with little hope of success, to make those norms less oppressive. Today, despite talk of sexual revolution, the ideology of possessive love has lost little of its power. But what is now at hand is the possibility of changing your individual dispositions in order to facilitate certain sorts of relationships. Instead of assuming that God or nature has made Homo sapiens monogamous or polygynous or heterosexual or polyamorous, you might now be more free than ordinary human beings have ever been in the past to choose your own sexual identity. In liberal societies, this has largely been achieved with sexual orientation, interpreted narrowly as the preferred gender of erotic partners. In two countries so far, Australia and Germany, a further choice has been made possible, allowing individuals to choose their own gender as male, female, or neither. From a crude administrative classification, that could be extended to include the specification of one's identity and preferences in different dimensions. The continuum between extremes of femininity and masculinity, including every degree between those, as well as the rejection of the very category of gender, is one such dimension. Others include preferred types of sexual connection, styles of loving, and modes of relationships. Once those choices are made, it might become possible to use various means, including experimentation, learning, and even chemistry, to change yourself accordingly. At best, such an expansion of possibilities in several dimensions could lead to a flowering of modes of sexuality, love, and relation, providing they exist in a political framework friendly to the multiculturalism of love. At worst, however, we might be led not to a paradise of diversity, but to a nightmare, brave new world in which everyone is suitably programmed for the subjective satisfaction of a restricted range of desires determined by some arbitrary conception of what might be politically expedient. In other words, pretty much a variant of the present system. Why speak of a nightmare? The brave new world technology may be at hand to line up both sides of the utopian equation, designing our desires and also the means of their satisfaction. In this way, the rate of satisfied desires would be optimized. That would not mean an Aladdin world where every wish is immediately granted, for a world that leaves nothing to be desired would be a grim one. Even in a utopia, there must be desire. But if things are adjusted to provide just enough excitement in frustration to maximize the pleasure in consummation, an ideal ratio could be devised of satisfaction to desires. Why would it matter in such a world if the resulting patterns were not as diverse or free as we now would think desirable? To try and answer such questions is to be thrown back into a thicket of philosophy. The matching of desires to satisfactions cannot suffice to make for a thriving human nature. The design of utopia is necessarily constrained by our imagination, and our imagination is constrained by our values, even if we remember that many of those values are unsupportable prejudices We cannot be wholly rid of them when attempting to construct utopia, though our goal would be to ensure that its denizens would view it as the best of all possible worlds. We must inevitably continue to judge it from a perspective colored by our own parochial values. Why is Huxley's Brave New World a dystopia? What is particularly disturbing about that world is that it sets up a small set of ways of being human, forming rigid castes. In the world we now live in, to be sure, our choices are heavily constrained by a genome that we did not choose, by historical circumstances into which we chanced to be born, and by vagaries of an upbringing in which we had little or no say. Nevertheless, we retain a powerful attachment to the idea that there are innumerable ways of being human. Your unique genome is only one of countless influences that shaped you in myriad ways. The multiplicity of possible experiences appears as a gift bestowed on us by nature herself, and it would be churlish to reject it. Variety in forms of life is attractive for both individual agents and in light of a comprehensive perspective on the world as a whole. Ecologists emphasize the value of diversity. Ethical and pragmatic factors are at stake. When we lose species of plants, we may lose potential cures for diseases yet unheard of. But we also value diversity for its own sake. The contemplation of the living world's astounding range in forms of life is awe-inspiring. Why should diversity in relationships not seem equally beautiful? And yet, in practice, we pigeonhole everyone and every relationship into one or two of a small number of categories: straight, gay, bi, single, married, engaged, or just friends. Why should this be? Here is a hypothesis which could explain our inclination to think in terms of limited categories, as well as give us a reason to overcome the temptation in our personal relations. Dividing people and relationships into types filters out the messy nuances of individual experience and enables us to talk about ourselves and others as if our sentiments and behavior were rational and intelligible. We can then more easily predict, explain, generalize, and gossip about people. Call this the peg on which we hang our talk about people. A stereotype is a useful shorthand. Each of us, however, knows that the common vocabulary used to hang our stories on that peg fits our private world only approximately. How much of our thinking about other people requires shortcuts devised for the peg? If we hope to see our lovers as they are, we need to strive to appreciate them in ways that go beyond prior categorization. Once again, it can help to think of love as a particularly intense form of aesthetic appreciation. When approaching a work of art, you cannot escape classifying it first in terms of a certain genre, period, and style. After that, you hope to be drawn into the endless intricacies of the particular. These are what make the work unique, and they can be appreciated even when they cannot readily be named. That attitude is no less appropriate to the target of love. Our social environment is not the only source of ideological stereotypes. Any human relationship, not just that of lovers, sets up expectations that have the force of norms. Even among strangers, a promise is expected to be kept. Norms can arise from love, when love is understood in terms of a prevalent ideology. That is the origin of Kipnis's long list of things forbidden in a couple. It constitutes a sort of tacit contract, with a good deal of small print that hedges the standard truisms about love with conditions and qualifications. That normative dimension of love would appall the Countess of Champagne. But could we entirely escape it? Could we live without ideology? Undoubtedly not, but perhaps we can lower its potential virulence. however much is bequeathed us by our genes and our chemistry. The world we live in is mostly made by the consequences of things we say, both about what we know and about what we value. Words rule our worlds. Sometimes the ecstasies of love seem to take us beyond all norms and conventions. Legend and history are littered with kingdoms lost and lives shattered by love. But when love is harnessed in the service of those very norms, into institutions like marriage and family, the backlash of repression can be as cruel as love itself. Throughout history, love has been punished more savagely than crime. Today, in those parts of the world where average people expect to enjoy a certain measure of individual freedom and the leisure to exercise it, we may glimpse the possibility of a truly pluralistic society. In such a society, a margin of freedom may be open within which social norms allow more meaningful and fulfilling lives, even for people whose temperament is eccentric. In such a society, the recognition of the possibility of multiple forms of polyamory may actually result in some monogamous relationships, freely entered into and maintained, and standing a better chance of success. Conceptions of the many forms that fulfilling lives might take must rest on facts about what is possible for human beings. As a society, we proceed by tiny steps, adjusting ourselves to our niche and our niche to ourselves. But when technology provides the means to make radical changes, both to our external environment and to our nature, we must choose everything at once, with hardly a fixed point on either side. That prospect is vertiginous. We are not quite there yet, but we can at least acknowledge that experiments in living are worth making. They can be made only where the society's norms include respect for the multifarious forms of life and love. Not long ago, slavery was sanctioned by God and morality. More recently, and even now in many places, the concept of true femininity unquestionably entailed that a normal woman was, by nature, weak, irrational, intellectually deficient, and submissive. Those attitudes were supported with an abundance of what were once truisms and are now rejected as obviously absurd. Might we someday view monogamism in the same light? Our descendants would look back on that ideology as a cruel and primitive prejudice. Singular relationships would flourish on the basis of individual personalities. Loving relationships would not be subject to rules inspired by the illusions of limerence. And Blake's future age would have arrived when love, sweet love, would be no crime. This concludes Love, by Ronald D'Souza. Narrated by Paul Heitsch, a member of SAG-AFTRA. Copyright 2015, by Ronald D'Souza. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Oxford University Press and was produced in the year 2021 by Tantor Media, Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright there, too. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.